catching and bubbling, as if in a narrow, constricted throat. In an instant she was plunged back, 28 years, to her first child's sickbed. She whispered her daughter's name.
"Susan?"
And the breathing quickened, and grew more liquid. A voice began to emerge from the bubbling mess of sound, a child's voice, she took it to be, high and pitiful, attempting, as if with tremendous effort, to form words. And Mrs. Ayres let the speaking tube drop, in absolute horror. She ran to the door. She didn't care what might be on the other side of it now. She hammered on the panels, calling wildly for Mrs. Baisley, and when no answer came, she darted unsteadily back across the room to one of the barred nursery windows and plucked at its catch. She had by this time begun to weep, tears of fright which almost blinded her. They and her panic must have stripped her of sense and strength, for the catch was a simple one and quite loose, but somehow it cut into her fingers and would not give. But there, below her, was Caroline, just making her brisk way up from the lawn to the southwest corner of the terrace, and at the sight of her Mrs. Ayres abandoned the catch and started banging at the window. She saw her daughter pause and raise her head, looking about, hearing the sound but unable to place it. A second later, to Mrs. Ayres's unutterable relief, she saw her lift up her hand in a gesture of recognition, but then she made out more clearly the direction of Caroline's gaze. She realized that she was looking not up at the nursery window, but straight ahead across the terrace. Pressing closer to the glass, she caught sight of a stoutish female figure running across the gravel, and recognized Mrs. Baisley. She saw her meet Caroline at the top of the terrace steps, and begin making quick, frightened gestures back to the hall. They were joined after a moment by Betty, who also ran across the terrace, beckoning them agitatedly on. All this time the unstoppered mouthpiece had been sending out its pitiful whisper. Now, seeing the three women below, Mrs. Ayres realized that she and the feeble, clamorous presence at the other end of the tube were alone together in that vast house. This was the moment when her panic tipped over into hysteria. She raised her fists and pummeled on the window, and two of the fine old panes gave way beneath her hands. Caroline, Mrs. Baisley, and Betty, hearing the sound of the breaking glass, looked up in amazement. They saw Mrs. Ayres shrieking from between the nursery bars, shrieking like a child, Mrs. Baisley said, and beating her hands against the edges of broken window. What happened to her in the time it took the women to make their stumbling, frightened way up to the nursery, no one could afterwards say. They found the door to the room ajar, and the speaking tube silent, the ivory whistle fixed neatly in its socket. Mrs. Ayres, herself, had worked herself rigidly into a corner and effectively blacked out. She was bleeding badly from the cuts on her hands and arms, so the three of them did what they could to bind up her wounds, tearing up one of her own silk scarves for bandages. They got her to her feet and half-walked, half-carried her downstairs to her bedroom, where they gave her brandy and tried to warm her, building up the fire in the grate and loading her with blanket after blanket. For now, in her shock, she'd begun to shake. She was still shaking when I saw her, just over an hour later. I had been visiting a patient, luckily a private patient with a telephone, so when Caroline put through a call to my surgery, the girl at the exchange was able to pass on her urgent request that I stop off at Hundreds on my way home. I drove to the hall as soon as I could, with no idea of what was awaiting me. I was utterly flabbergasted to find the house in such a state. A white-faced Betty took me up to Mrs. Ayres. She was sitting with Caroline at her side, hunched and shivering, staring like a hare at every slight, unexpected movement or sound. And at the first sight of her, I faltered. Her expression was so wild she looked just like her son, just like Roderick in the last, worst phase of his delusions. Her hair was straggling around her shoulders, and her arms and hands were ghastly. The blood had caught in her bulky rings, turning all the stones to rubies. But her wounds, by a miracle, turned out to be fairly superficial. I cleaned them up and dressed and bound them, and then, taking Caroline's place, I simply sat and gently held her hands. Bit by bit, the worst of the wildness faded from her gaze, and she told me what had happened to her, shuddering and weeping with every fresh twist of it, and covering her face. But at last she looked squarely and urgently into my eyes.
"You understand what's happened?" she said. "You see what this means? I failed her, Doctor. She came, and I failed her."
She clutched my fingers. clutched them so hard I saw the blood rising to the surface of her dressings, as her wounds reopened. "Mrs. Ayres," I said, trying to steady her. She wouldn't listen.
"My darling girl! I wanted her to come, you see, so desperately. I've felt her here in this house. I've lain in my bed and felt her near. So near she was. But I was greedy. I wanted her nearer. I drew her by wishing for her to come, and then she came, and I was afraid. I was afraid of her and failed her. And now I don't know what frightens me more, the thought that she'll never come to me again, or the thought that in failing her I've made her hate me. Will she hate me, Doctor? Say she won't."
I said, "Nobody hates you. You must be calm."
"But I failed her! I failed her!"
"You failed no one. Your daughter loves you." She looked into my face.
"You think she does?"
"Of course she does."
"You promise me?"
"I promise you," I said. I would have said anything at that moment, simply to calm her down. And soon I forbade her to speak any more, and I gave her a sedative and put her to bed. She lay fretful for a time, with her bandaged hands still clasped in mine, but the sedative was a strong one, and once she was sleeping I gently disengaged my fingers from hers and went downstairs, to go over the incident with Caroline, Mrs. Baisley, and Betty. They were gathered together in the little parlour, looking as pale and as shaken almost as Mrs. Ayres herself. Caroline had handed out glasses of brandy, and the alcohol on top of the shock had made Mrs. Baisley tearful. I questioned her and Betty as closely as I could, but all they could confirm of Mrs. Ayres's story was that she had gone up to the second floor alone, and that she had stayed there so long, they thought about 15 or 20 minutes, they had grown anxious about her and had gone out to alert Caroline, and then that all three of them had seen her crying out in that dreadful way at the broken window. When I had pieced together their side of things, I went up to the day nursery to examine the scene for myself. I had never been up to the second floor before, and I made the ascent warily, pretty shaken by the mood of the house. I found the bare room looking hideous with its broken window, and its streaks and splashes of darkening blood. But its door moved smoothly on its hinges, and the key moved glibly too in the lock. I tried turning the key with the door both closed and open. I even gave the door a slam to see if that might jar the mechanism. It had no effect at all. I listened again at that wretched speaking tube, and as before, heard nothing. So then I went through to the old night nursery, just as Mrs. Ayres had, and I stood very still and expectant, thinking of the dead child, Susan, thinking of my mother, thinking a thousand gloomy things, holding my breath, almost daring something to happen, someone or something to come. But nothing did happen. The house seemed deathly silent and chill. The room felt bleak, unhappy, but quite lifeless. I did consider one explanation, that somebody had staged the whole affair with the intention of tormenting Mrs. Ayres, either as a sort of ghastly joke or out of simple malice. I could hardly suspect Caroline, and since I wouldn't believe it of Mrs. Baisley, who'd been a servant at the house since before the war, my suspicions had to fall on Betty. It was possible that she, after all, had somehow been behind the business with the speaking tube in the first place, and Mrs. Ayres herself had said that the footsteps she had heard, going back and forth beyond the door, were light ones, light as a child's. According to Mrs. Baisley, Betty had been down in the hall with her throughout the entire incident, though she also admitted that, in her anxiety for Mrs. Ayres, she had gone further up the staircase while Betty had hung back. Could the girl have run to the servants' stairs, made her rapid way up them, locked the nursery door, and then gone pattering back and forth in the passage, all without the other woman's having missed her? It seemed very unlikely. I had come up by the back stairs myself, and had examined them pretty closely by the flame of my lighter. They were covered with a fine layer of dust, which my own shoes instantly disturbed. But there were no other footmarks, heavy or soft. I was quite certain. And then Betty's distress over the incident seemed very genuine. I knew she was fond of her mistress. And finally, of course, there was Mrs. Ayres's own word against her involvement, for she had seen the girl with Mrs. Baisley outside the house while the sounds in the speaking tube went on. I ran through all this in my mind, looking over that bleak room, but soon the oppressions of the place proved too much for me. I wet my handkerchief at the basin and cleared up the worst of the blood. I found a few loose pieces of linoleum and did what I could to block up the broken panes of window. Then I went heavily back downstairs. I went down by the main staircase and met Caroline on the first landing, just coming out of her mother's room. She touched her finger to her lips, and we carried on silently together to the little parlour. When we were inside with the door closed, I said, "How is she?" She shivered. "She's sleeping. I thought I heard her call out, that's all. I don't want her to wake up and be frightened." "Well," I said, "she should sleep for hours with the veronal inside her. Come and sit by the fire. You're cold. And God knows, so am I." I led her to the hearth, drew the chairs close together before it, and we sat. I put my elbows on my knees and my face in my hands. Beaten and weary, I rubbed my eyes. She said, "You've been upstairs." I nodded, gazing blearily at her. "Oh, Caroline, that horrible room. It looks like a lunatic's cell up there. I've locked the door of it. I think you should leave it locked now. Don't go up there." She looked away from me towards the fire.
"Another room shut up?" she said.
I was still rubbing at my sore eyes. "Well, that's the least of our worries right now. It's your mother we need to think about. I just can't believe this has happened, can you?" "And she was quite herself this morning?" She said, without drawing her gaze from the flames,
"She was no different from how she was yesterday, if that's what you mean."
"She'd slept well?"
"As far as I know. I oughtn't to have gone down to the houses, I suppose. I oughtn't to have left her."
I lowered my hands. "Don't be silly. If anyone's at fault here, it's me. You've been telling me for weeks that she hasn't been herself. I wish to God I'd paid more attention. I'm so sorry, Caroline. I had no idea her mind was as unsettled as this. If those cuts had been deeper, if she'd caught an artery..." She looked frightened. I reached for her hand. "Forgive me. This is dreadful for you, to see your mother in such a state. These fantasies of hers," I spoke reluctantly, "these ideas about your sister, that your sister's been visiting her. Did you know about that?" She gazed back at the fire again.
"No, but it makes sense now. She's been spending so much time alone. I thought it was tiredness. Instead, up in her room, she must have been thinking that Susan... Oh, it's grotesque. It's filthy."
Her pale cheeks had coloured.
"And it is my fault, no matter what you say. I knew that something like this would happen, that it was only a matter of time."
"Well," I said miserably, "then I should have known it too, and I could have kept a closer eye on her."
"It doesn't matter how closely you watch," she said. "We watched Roderick, remember? I should have taken her away, right away, from hundreds."
There was something odd about the way she said this, and as she spoke she looked at me, then almost furtively dropped her gaze. I said, "What do you mean, Caroline?"
"Well, isn't it obvious?" she said. "It's something in this house, something that's been here all along and has just woken up.
Or something that's come here to punish and spite us.
You saw how my mother was when you arrived. You heard what happened to her. You heard Mrs. Baisley and Betty."
I was gazing at her in disbelief. I said, "You can't seriously mean... You can't believe..." "Caroline, listen." I reached across her for her other hand and held her fingers tightly in mine. I said, "You, your mother, Mrs. Baisley, Betty. You're all of you at the end of your tethers. This house, yes, has put thoughts in your heads. But is that so surprising? One grim thing has led so clearly to another. First Jip, then Roderick, and now this. Surely you can see that. You aren't your mother, Caroline. You're stronger than she is. Why, I remember her sitting weeping where you're sitting now months ago. She must have been fretting over the memory of your sister ever since those wretched scribbles appeared. She's been unwell, not sleeping. Her age is against her, too. And then that foolish business with the speaking tube.
And the locked door, the footsteps.
The door was probably never even shut. It was open, wasn't it, when you and Mrs. Baisley went up there? And the whistle was back in its place. As for the footsteps, I dare say she heard some sound. She thought she heard Jip's footsteps once, you remember? That must have been all it took, for her mind to begin to give way." She shook her head, frustrated.
"You have an answer for everything.
A rational answer, yes.
You aren't seriously suggesting that your sister...
No, she said firmly. No, I'm not suggesting that.
What, then? That some other ghost entirely is haunting your mother? The same ghost, presumably, that made those marks in Roderick's room.
Well, something made them, didn't it?
She cried, pulling her hands out of my grip.
Something's here, I know it is. I think I've known it ever since Rod got ill, but I was too afraid to face it. I keep thinking, too, of what my mother said when that last set of scribbles was found. She said the house knows all our weaknesses and is testing them one by one. Roddy's weakness was the house itself, you see. Mine? Well, perhaps mine was Jip. But Mother's weakness is Susan. It's as if, with the scribbles, the footsteps, the voice, it's as if she's being teased, as if something's playing with her.
I said, Caroline, you can't possibly believe that.
Oh, she answered angrily, it's all right for you. You can talk about delusions and fantasies and things like that, but you don't know this family, not really. You've only seen us like this. We were different a year ago. I'm sure we were. Things have changed, gone wrong so badly, so quickly. There has to be something, don't you see?
Her face was white now and stricken. I put my hand on her arm. Look, you're tired. You're all of you tired.
You keep on saying that.
Well, unfortunately, it keeps on being true.
But this is more than mere tiredness, surely. Why won't you see that?
I see what's in front of me, I said. Then I make sensible deductions. That's what doctors do. She gave a cry that was part frustration, part a sort of disgust. But the cry seemed to use up the last of her strength. She covered her eyes, sat still and stiff for a second, and then her shoulders sank.
I just don't know, she said. Sometimes it seems clear. Other times it's just too much. It's all too much.
I drew her towards me to kiss and smooth her head. Then I spoke to her, quietly and calmly. My darling, I'm so sorry. This is hard, I know, but it won't help anyone, your mother least of all, if we avoid the obvious. Things have clearly become too difficult for her. There's nothing odd or supernatural about that. I think she's been trying to retreat to an era, that's all, when her life was easier. How many times has she spoken wistfully about the past? She must have made your sister into a sort of figure for everything she's lost. I think her mind, with rest, will clear. Truly, I do. I think it would help her, too, if the estate could get back on its feet. I paused. If we were to marry, she moved away.
I can't think of marrying with my mother like this.
Surely it would reassure her, to see things settled, to see you settled.
No. No, it wouldn't be right.
I struggled for a second with a frustration of my own, then spoke measuredly again. Very well. But your mother's going to need careful nursing now. She's going to need all our help. She doesn't need to be frightened or alarmed with any sort of fancy. You understand me, Caroline? After a slight hesitation, she closed her eyes and gave me a nod. But after that, we sat in silence. She folded her arms and moved forward in her chair, gazing into the fire again as if brooding over the flames. I stayed with her as long as I could, but at last had to leave for the hospital. I told her to rest. I promised to return first thing in the morning, and meanwhile she was to call me if her mother showed any signs of upset or agitation. Then I went softly back down to the kitchen to say the same thing to Betty and Mrs. Baisley, adding that I wanted them to keep an eye on Caroline herself, who I thought was feeling the strain a little. And before I left, I looked in on Mrs. Ayres. She was sleeping heavily, with her poor bandaged arms flung out, her long hair tangled on her pillow. She began to stir and murmur as I stood beside her bed, but I laid my hand across her forehead and stroked her pale, anxious face. And soon she was still. Chapter 11 I didn't know what to expect when I returned to Hundreds next morning. Life at the house had reached a point where it seemed to me that, in my absence, absolutely anything might happen. That when I stepped into the hall at around 8 o'clock, I found Caroline coming downstairs to greet me, looking tired but with reassuring touches of life and colour in her cheeks. She told me that they had all passed an uneventful night. Her mother had slept deeply and since waking had been quite calm. "Thank God," I said. "And how does she seem?
There's no confusion.
Apparently not.
Has she spoken about what happened? She hesitated, then turned and began to head back upstairs.
Come and talk to her yourself.
So I followed her up. The room, I was pleased to see, was light, with its curtains drawn wide, and Mrs. Ayres, though still in her nightclothes, was out of her bed, sitting by the fire, her hair tied back in a loose plait. She looked apprehensively at the opening door as we went in, but the alarm passed from her face when she saw Caroline and me. Her gaze met mine, and she blinked and coloured, as if in simple embarrassment. I said, "Well, Mrs. Ayres, I came early, thinking you might need me. I see I'm hardly needed at all." I crossed to her, pulling over the padded stool from beneath her dressing-table so that I could sit at her side and examine her. I said quietly, "How are you feeling?" Close to, I could see that her eyes were dark and still glassy from the sedative I'd given her the day before, and her pose was a rather weak one, but her voice, though low, was clear and steady. She put down her head and said,
"I feel like a perfect fool."
"Now don't be silly," I answered, smiling. "How did you sleep?"
"So deeply. I don't really remember. That's thanks to your medicine, I suppose."
"No bad dreams?"
"I don't think so."
"Good. Now, first things first." I gently took her hands in mine. "May I look at your dressings?" She turned her face from me, but meekly extended her arms. She had pulled down her cuffs to cover the bandages, and when I put them back I saw that the dressings were stained and ought to be changed. I went around the landing to the bathroom and brought back a bowl of warm water. Even with the water, however, the business of easing free the lint from the wounds was not very pleasant. Caroline stood to one side, looking on silently as I worked. Mrs. Ayres herself bore the operation without a murmur, only catching her breath now and then as the bandage tugged. The cuts, on the whole, were closing well. I carefully applied new dressings. Caroline moved forward to take away the bowl of tinted water and to roll up the soiled bandages, and while she was doing that I gently took her mother's pulse and blood pressure, then listened at her chest. Her breaths were mildly laboured, but her heartbeat, I was pleased to find, was quick and very firm. I closed the lapels of her dressing-gown and put my instruments away. Gently taking hold of her hands again, I said, "I think you're doing very nicely. I'm relieved to see it. You gave the house quite a scare yesterday." She drew away her fingers.
"Don't let's talk about it, please."
"You had a very serious fright, Mrs. Ayres."
"I behaved like a foolish old woman, that's all."
Her voice, for the first time, lost some of its steadiness. She closed her eyes, then tried to smile.
"I'm afraid my mind ran away with itself. This house breeds fancies. Such silly thoughts. We're too isolated out here. My husband always used to say that this hall was the loneliest house in Warwickshire. Didn't your father used to say that, Caroline?"
Caroline was still tidying away the bandages. She said quietly, without looking up,
"He did."
I turned from her, back to her mother. "Well, the house in its present condition is certainly partly to blame. But when I saw you yesterday, you said some very startling things."
"I said a lot of nonsense. I'm ashamed to remember it. What Betty and Mrs. Baisley must think, I simply can't imagine. Oh, please don't let's talk about it, Doctor."
I said carefully, "It seems a serious matter to ignore."
"We haven't ignored it. You've given me medicine. Caroline's been looking after me. I'm quite well now."
"You haven't felt anxious? Afraid?"
"Afraid?" She laughed. "Good heavens! Of what?"
"Well, yesterday you seemed very afraid. You spoke of Susan." She moved in her chair.
"I told you. I spoke a lot of nonsense. I'd had too much on my mind. I'd been spending too much time alone. I realize that now. I shall sit more with Caroline in future, in the evenings and so on. Please don't nag at me. Please don't."
She put her bandaged hand over mine, her eyes looking dark and large and still rather glassy in her drawn face. But her voice had levelled again, and her tone seemed very sincere. There was no trace of the staring, babbling woman who had greeted me yesterday. I said at last, "Very well. But I'd like you to rest now. I think you ought to go back to bed. I shall give Caroline a prescription for you, just a mild sedative, that's all. I want you sleeping 8 dreamless hours a night until your strength returns. How does that sound?
As though I'm an invalid,
she answered, a hint of playfulness entering her tone. Well, I'm the doctor here. You must allow me to decide who the invalids are. She rose, grumbling slightly, but allowed me to help her back to bed. I gave her another Veronal, a lower dose this time, and Caroline and I sat beside her until, sighing and murmuring, she slept. When we were sure she was slumbering properly, we slipped from the room. We stood on the landing. I looked at the shut door, shaking my head. She's so much better. It's incredible. Has she been like that all morning?
She's been just like that, Caroline answered, not quite meeting my gaze.
She seems almost her old self.
You think so?
I looked at her. Don't you?
I'm not so sure. Mother's very good, you know, at hiding her real feelings. All that generation are, especially the women.
Well, she seemed very much better than I expected to find her. If we can just keep her quiet now. She gave me a glance.
Quiet? You really think we can do that? Here?
The question struck me as a strange one, given that we were standing, talking in murmurs at the centre of that hushed house. But before I could answer, she had moved away from me. She said,
"Come downstairs for a moment, will you? To the library. I want to show you something."
I followed her uncertainly down to the hall. She opened the library door, then stood aside for me to go on in ahead of her. The room smelt mustier than ever after all the winter rains. The shelves were still draped with sheets, still looking faintly ghostly in the dimness, but she or Betty had opened up the single working window shutter, and an ashy fire was smoking itself out in the grate. Two lamps were arranged beside an armchair. I looked at them in some surprise. "You've been sitting in here?"
"I've been reading," she said, "while Mother's been asleep. I spoke to Betty yesterday, you see, after you left, and she set me thinking."
She took a step back out into the hall and called Betty's name. She must have put the girl to wait somewhere, for she called quite softly, but Betty appeared almost at once. She followed Caroline over the threshold, then caught sight of me in the gloom and hesitated. Caroline said,
"Come right inside, and close the door behind you, please."
The girl came forward, bowing her head.
"Now,"
said Caroline. She had put her hands together and was working the fingers of one over the knuckles of the other, as if absently trying to smooth out the papery roughness of her own skin.
"I want you to tell Dr. Faraday what you told me yesterday."
Betty hesitated again, then mumbled,
"I don't like to, miss." "Come on, don't be silly. No one's cross with you. What did you come and tell me yesterday afternoon after the doctor had gone home?" "Please, miss," she said with a glance at me. "I told you this house has got summat bad in it."
I must have made some sound or gesture of dismay. Betty lifted her head and stuck out her chin.
"It does too, and I knowed that months ago. And I told doctor and he said I were only being daft. But I wa'n't being daft. I knowed there was summat. I felt un."
Caroline was watching me. I looked over and met her gaze and said stiffly, "It's perfectly true that I asked Betty not to mention this."
"Tell Dr. Faraday what you felt exactly," she said, as if she hadn't heard. "I just felt him," Betty said more feebly, "in the house. He's like a wicked servant."
"A wicked servant," I said. She stamped her foot.
"He is. He used to move things about up here. He never did nothing downstairs, but he used to push things over and make stuff mucky, as though he touched it with dirty hands. I nearly said summat after that fire, but Mrs. Baisley said I oughtn't to, because Mr. Roderick was to blame for that. But then all them queer things happened with Mrs. Ayres, all them pops and flappings, and then I did say summat. I said summat to Madam herself."
Now I began to understand. I folded my arms. "I see. Well, that explains a great deal. And what did Mrs. Ayres say?"
"She said she knowed all about it. She said it was a ghost. She said she liked it. She said it was hers and my secret, and I wasn't to say. And I didn't say another word after that, not even to Mrs. Baisley. And I thought that must be all right, because Mrs. Ayres seemed so happy. But now the ghost's turned wicked again, hasn't he? And I wish I had spoken, for then Madam wouldn't have got hurt. And I'm sorry, but it ain't my fault."
She began to cry, putting up her hands to cover her face, her shoulders heaving. Caroline went across to her and said,
"All right, Betty. No one's blaming you for anything. You were very good and sensible yesterday when the rest of us were so shaken. Wipe your eyes."
Eventually the girl calmed down, and Caroline sent her back to the basement. She went meekly, but with a baleful look at me, and when she had gone I stood for a moment with my eyes on the shut door, very conscious of the silence and of Caroline's watchful gaze. Turning at last, I said, "She mentioned something to me the morning I destroyed Jip. You were all so unhappy I didn't want to risk upsetting you further. When all that business started with Rod, I thought some of it might have come from her, that she might have put the idea into his head. She swore she hadn't."
"I don't think she had," said Caroline.
She had crossed to the armchair, and now, from the table beside it, picked up two hefty books. She held them against her chest and drew in her breath, and when she spoke again it was with a quiet sort of dignity. She said,
"I don't care that you didn't mention this to me before. I don't care that I had to hear it from Betty, rather than from you. I know what you think about what's been happening in this house, but I want you to listen to me, just for a little while. You owe me that, I think."
I took a step towards her, but her pose and manner were forbidding. I stopped and said cautiously, "All right." She drew another deep breath and went on.
"After Betty spoke to me yesterday, I began to think things over. I suddenly remembered some books of my father's. I remembered the titles and came looking for them last night. I half thought they might have been given away, but anyway I found them."
With a puzzling diffidence, she handed the two heavy books to me. I don't know what I expected them to be. I think from the look of them I thought they might be medical textbooks. Then I saw the titles, Phantasms of the Living, and The Night Side of Nature. "Caroline," I said, letting the books sink at my sides, "I can't believe that these will help us." She saw that I didn't mean to open them and took them back and opened one herself. She did it fumblingly, as if not quite in command of her own movements. I looked again at the colour in her cheeks and realized that what I had been taking for a blush of health was actually a sort of agitation. She found a page that she had marked with a slip of paper and began to read aloud.
"On the first day," she read, "the family were startled all at once by a mysterious movement among the things in the sitting rooms and kitchen and other parts of the house. At one time, without any visible agency, one of the jugs came off the hook over the dresser and was broken. Then followed another, and next day another. A china teapot, with the tea just made in it and placed on the mantelpiece, whisked off onto the floor."
She looked up at me, shyly but with a trace of defiance. Her colour was deeper than ever now. She said,
"That was in London in the 1800s.
She turned a few pages to another slip.
"This is in Edinburgh in 1835. Do what they would, the thing went on just the same. Footsteps of invisible feet, knockings and scratchings and rustlings, first on one side and then on the other, were heard daily and nightly."
"Caroline," I said. She turned more pages, turned one so hastily it tore.
"And here, listen to this. I meet with numerous extraordinary records of a preternatural ringing of all the bells in a house, sometimes occurring periodically for a considerable time, and continuing after precautions have been taken which precluded the possibility of trick or deception."
I took the book back from her hands. "Very well," I said. "Let me look at it." I turned to the title page. The list of chapter headings struck me, and with a touch of distaste I read them aloud. "The Dweller in the Temple. Double Dreaming and Trance. Troubled Spirits. Haunted Houses." Again I let the book sink. "Didn't we discuss this yesterday? Do you really think your mother will recover if you encourage her in thinking that this house has a ghost in it?"
"But I don't think that," she said quickly. "I don't think that at all. I know it's what Mother believes. I know it's what Betty thinks, too. But these things the book talks about, they're not ghosts. If anything, they're poltergeists."
"Poltergeists?" I said. "God, why not vampires? Or werewolves?" She shook her head, frustrated.
"A year ago I might have said the same, but it's just a word, isn't it? A word for something we don't understand, some sort of energy or collection of energies, or something inside us, I don't know. "These writers here, Gurney and Byers," she opened the other book, "they talk about phantasms. They're not ghosts. They're parts of a person."
"Parts of a person?"
"Unconscious parts. So strong or so troubled, they can take on a life of their own."
She showed me a page.
"Look, here's a man in England, anxious, wanting to speak to his friend, appearing to the woman and her companion at exactly that moment in an hotel room in Cairo, appearing as his own ghost. Here's a woman at night hearing a fluttering bird, just like mother. Then she sees her husband, who's in America, standing there before her. Later, she finds out he's dead. The book says, with some sorts of people, when they're unhappy or troubled, or they want something badly, sometimes they don't even know it's happening, something breaks away from them. And what I can't stop thinking is, I keep thinking back to those telephone calls. Suppose it's Roddy. All of it."
I said in amazement, "What?"
"Well, if this book is right, then someone's at the root of it. And suppose it's my brother doing it all. Suppose he wants to come back to us. You know how unhappy he could get, how frustrated. That ghost of Betty's, it might have been him the whole time."
I said, "It might have been Betty herself. Have you thought of that? You've only had trouble, haven't you, since she's been in the house?" She made a gesture of impatience, dismissing the idea.
"You might as well say we've only had trouble since you've been in it. You aren't listening to me. The noises, the bells, they're all signals, aren't they? Even the scribbles on the walls, the voice in the speaking tube yesterday. According to Mother, it was faint, only really a breath. Maybe she only supposed it was Susan's, because that's what she wanted to hear. Maybe it was really Rod's."
"But there was no voice," I said. "There couldn't have been. As for the bells, we've been over this, the faulty wires."
"But here, in this book..."
I put my hands over hers with the book between us. I said, "Caroline, please, this is nonsense. You know it is. It's a fairy tale, for God's sake. I had a patient once who tried to hit his wife over the head with a hammer. He said she wasn't really his wife at all. Another woman had swallowed her up, and he had to smash open the false wife's head to let the real one out. No doubt this book would back him up. A nice case of spirit possession. Instead, we got the man into hospital and gave him lithium, and in a week he was sane again. How would the book account for that? They're giving your brother lithium, too. He's been a very ill young man. But to suggest that he might be haunting hundreds like some sort of spook..." I saw a flicker of doubt in her expression. But she said stubbornly,
"If you use words like that, then it's bound to sound foolish. But you don't live here. You don't know. Last night it all made sense to me. Listen."
She opened the book again and found another passage that seemed to her to demonstrate her point. After that she found another. I looked at her face, which was really flushed now, the blood beating almost hectically across it. I looked at her jerky, intent gaze, and I hardly knew her. I took hold of her hand. She didn't notice. She was still reading aloud from the book. I moved my fingers to her wrist, trying to feel for her pulse. I caught the rapid tick-tick of it. She became aware of my purposeful grip. She pulled away from me, almost in horror.
"What are you doing? Stop it! Stop it!"
"Caroline," I said,
"you're treating me like you treated my mother, like you treated Rod. Is that all you can do?"
"Well, for God's sake," I cried, my weariness and frustration catching up with me. "I'm a doctor. What do you expect? You stand there reading me that nonsense. You aren't some superstitious country girl. Look around you. Look what you've got. This house is falling down around your ears. Your brother brought the estate to the brink of ruin and blamed it all on an infection. Now you're finishing off the job, blaming spooks and poltergeists. I can't listen to any more of it. It's making me sick." I turned away, almost shaking, startled by the force of my own words. I heard her set aside the book, and with an effort I calmed myself down. I put my hand across my eyes and said, "Forgive me, Caroline. I didn't mean any of that."
"No," she said quietly. "I'm glad you said it. You're right. Even about Roddy. I shouldn't have shown you. It isn't your problem."
I turned back to her, the anger flaring up again. "Of course it's my problem. We're going to be married, aren't we? Though God knows when. Oh, don't look at me like that." I caught hold of her hands. "I can't bear to see you upset, but I can't bear to see you misled either. You're just giving yourself more things to worry about. There are enough already, aren't there? Real things, I mean, in the real world, that we can do something about. Again I saw doubt in her eyes. Again, she said,
but last night it seemed to make such sense. Everything seemed to fall into place. I thought about Roddy so much, I could almost feel him here.
A few days ago, I answered, listening to that damn speaking tube, I convinced myself I could almost hear my mother. She frowned.
You did?
I lifted her hands and kissed them. This house, I said, is making us all crazy, but not in the way you think. Things have got out of control here. But we can fix that, you and I. Meanwhile, well, it's perfectly understandable that you're worried about Rod. Let's go and see him, if that will help. Her head had been lowered, but at my words she looked up, and for the first time in weeks I saw a little leap of brightness in her eyes. That gave me a different sort of pang. I wished the brightness were for me. She said,
"You mean it?"
"Of course I do. I don't advise it. I don't think, for Rod's sake, that we should. But that's a different matter. It's you I'm thinking of now. It's always you I'm thinking of, Caroline. You must know that." And as it had once before, the last of my anger shifted, somehow transformed itself into desire. I drew her to me. She resisted for a moment, then her arms came around me, slender and hard.
"Yes," she murmured tiredly, "yes, I do."
We drove to the clinic the following Sunday, leaving Mrs. Ayres sleeping at home with Betty to watch her. The day was dry but dark. The journey inevitably was a rather tense one. I had called ahead to arrange our visit, but
"Suppose he won't see us?"
Caroline asked me a dozen times along the way, and
"Suppose he's worse? Suppose he doesn't even recognize us?"
"Then at least we'll know," I answered. "That will be something, won't it?" At last she fell silent, biting her nails. When I drew up in the courtyard, she kept still for a moment, reluctant to get out. We went in through the clinic door, and she gripped my arm in real panic. But then a nurse took us through to the day room, and we saw Roderick sitting waiting for us alone at one of the tables, and she left my side and went quickly over to him, laughing with nervousness and relief.
"Rod, is it you? I hardly knew you. You look like a sea captain."
He had put on weight. His hair was shorter than when we had last seen it, and he'd grown a ruddy-coloured beard. The beard was uneven because of his burns. His face behind it seemed to me to have lost its youth, to have settled in hard, humourless lines. He didn't return his sister's smiles. He let her lean to kiss his cheek and put her arms around him, but then he sat, on the other side of the table, putting his hands on the table's surface, I noticed, in a deliberate kind of way, as if liking the solidity of it. I took the chair beside Caroline's. "It's good to see you, Rod."
"It's wonderful to see you," said Caroline, laughing again. "How are you?"
He moved his tongue against his teeth, his mouth dry. He looked wary, suspicious.
"I'm all right."
"You're fat as anything. They must be feeding you well, at least. Are they? Is the food okay?"
He frowned.
"I suppose so."
"And are you pleased to see us?"
He didn't answer that. Instead, he glanced over at the window.
"How did you get here?"
"We came in Dr. Faraday's car."
He moved his tongue again.
"The little ruby."
"That's right," I said. He looked at me, still wary.
"They only told me this morning that you were coming."
Caroline said,
"We only decided to, this week."
"Isn't Mother with you?"
I saw her hesitate. I spoke instead. "I'm sorry to say your mother has a touch of bronchitis, Rod. Just a touch. She'll be all right soon."
"She sends her love," said Caroline, brightly. "She was very sorry not to come."
"They only told me this morning," he said again. "They're like that here. They keep things secret, so as not to frighten us. They don't want us to lose our heads, you see. It's just like the RAF, really."
He shifted his hands. I saw then that they were shaking. Keeping them flat upon the table must have helped to still them. I think Caroline saw the tremor, too. She put her own hands over his.
"We just wanted to see you, Rod," she said. "We haven't seen you for months. We wanted to be sure that you're all right."
He frowned down at her fingers, and for a moment we were silent. Then she exclaimed again over his beard, his extra weight. She asked after his daily routines, and he told us, in an uninvolved kind of way, how he passed his time now. The hours he spent in the craft room, making clay models. The meals, the spells of recreation, of singing, occasional gardening. He spoke lucidly enough, but with his features never breaking out of their stiff, new, mirthless lines, and his manner still very cautious. Then Caroline's questions became more hesitant. Was he really all right? Would he say if he wasn't? Was there anything he wanted? Did he think very often of home? And he began to look at us both with cold suspicion.
"Doesn't Dr. Warren tell you how I am?"
"Yes, he writes to us every week, but we wanted to see you. I had an idea."
"What idea?" he said quickly.
"That you might be unhappy."
The tremor in his hands became more violent, and his mouth set tight. He sat stiffly for a moment, then jerked away from the table and folded his arms.
"I won't go back," he said.
"What?"
asked Caroline, bewildered. His sudden movement had made her start.
"If that's why you're here..."
"We just wanted to see you."
"Is that why you're here? To take me back?"
"No, of course it isn't. At least, I hoped."
"It isn't fair, if that's why you've come. You can't bring a chap to a place like this and let him get used to it, let him get used to having no ties, and then send him back into that sort of danger."
"Roddy, please," said Caroline. "I wish you'd come home. I wish it more than anything. I wish you'd come home with Dr. Faraday and me right now. But if you'd rather stay here, if you're happier here..."
"It isn't a question of where I'm happier," he said with great contempt. "It's a question of where it's safer for me to be. Don't you know anything?"
"Roddy..."
"You want to put me in charge again? Is that it? When any fool could see that if you give me something, I'll hurt it."
"It wouldn't be like that," I said, seeing Caroline shaken by his words. "Hundreds is being well looked after now. Caroline is looking after it, and I'm helping. You wouldn't have to do anything you didn't care to do. We'd do it for you."
"Oh, that's clever,"
he said, as if talking sneeringly to a stranger.
"That's bloody good. You mean to trick me back like that? You just want to use me. To use me and blame me. Well, I won't go back. I won't be blamed, do you hear me?"
"Please," said Caroline, "stop talking like this. No one wants to take you back. I had the idea, that's all, that you were unhappy, that you wanted to see me. I'm sorry. I made a mistake."
"Do you think I'm an idiot?"
he said.
"No."
"Are you an idiot?"
she flinched.
"I just made a mistake."
"Rod..." I began. But a nurse had been sitting near us all this time, discreetly overseeing the visit, and now, having registered the change in him, she came over.
"What's all this?" she asked him mildly. "You're not upsetting your sister, surely?"
"I won't talk to the bloody fools,"
he said, looking rigidly away, his arms still folded.
"And I won't have language," said the nurse, folding her own arms. "Now, will you apologize?"
"No,"
she tapped her foot.
"We're waiting."
Rod said nothing. She shook her head, and, with her face turned to him but her eyes on Caroline and me, she said, in over-clear nursery tones,
"Roderick's a mystery to the clinic, Miss Ayres. Dr. Faraday. When he's in temper, he's the nicest chap, and all we nurses love him. But when he's out of it..."
She shook her head again and drew in her breath and tutted. Caroline said,
"It's all right. He needn't apologize if he doesn't want to. I don't want to make him do anything he doesn't want to do."
She gazed at her brother, then reached across the table again and spoke quietly and humbly.
"We miss you, Roddy, that's all. Mother and I, we miss you so much. We think about you all the time. Hundreds is horrible without you. I just thought you might be thinking of us, too. I see now that you're doing fine. I'm so glad."
Rod remained stubbornly silent, but his features tightened and his breathing grew laboured, as if he were keeping in check some tremendous emotion. The nurse moved closer to us and spoke more confidentially.
"I'd let him alone now if I were you. I should hate for you to see him in one of his rages."
We had spent less than 10 minutes with him. Caroline rose reluctantly, unable to believe that her brother would let us go without a word or look. But he didn't turn, and at last we had to leave him. She went on ahead to the car while I spoke briefly with Dr. Warren, and when I joined her, her eyes were red but dry. She had been crying and had blotted the tears. I took her hand. "That was grim. I'm sorry." But she spoke tonelessly.
"No, we shouldn't have come. I should have listened to you before. I've been stupid thinking we'd find something here. There's nothing, is there? Nothing. It's all just how you said."
We began the long trip back to Hundreds. I put my arm around her whenever the driving would allow. She kept her hands open in her lap, and her head moved slackly against my shoulder with the motion of the car, as if, disappointed, bewildered, she had lost all resistance and life. None of this, of course, was particularly inspiring to romance, and our affair, for the moment, rather languished. Between the frustrations of that, and my anxiety about her and about Hundreds generally, I began to feel burdened and fretful, sleeping poorly, with muddled dreams. I thought several times of confiding in Graham and Anne, but it was many weeks since I had spent any proper time with them. I had the impression they were slightly hurt by my neglect, and I didn't like to go creeping back to them now in a spirit of failure. At last even my work started to suffer. On one of my evenings at the hospital I found myself assisting on some routine piece of minor surgery, and I did the job so badly the physician in charge laughed at me and finished it off himself. It happened to be Seeley. We stood together afterwards washing our hands, and I apologized for my distraction. He answered with his usual affability.
"Not at all. You look done up. I know the feeling. Too many night calls, I suppose. This bad weather doesn't help."
I said, "No, it doesn't, does it?" I turned away from him, but felt his eyes still on me. We went through to the common room to retrieve our outdoor things, and as I lifted down my jacket from its hook, it somehow slithered through my fingers, spilling the contents of its pockets to the floor. I swore and bent to gather them up, and when I rose I found that Seeley was watching me again.
"You're in a bad way," he said, smiling.
He lowered his voice.
"What's the problem? Patient troubles or your own? Forgive my asking."
"No, it's all right," I said. "It's patient business, I suppose. But then again, mine too, in a way." I very nearly said more, badly wanting to get the thing off my chest, but thinking back to that unpleasant little moment at the January dance. Perhaps Seeley was also recalling it, and wanted to make up for his behaviour, or perhaps he could simply see from my manner how really troubled I was. He said,
"Look, I'm all finished here now, and I assume you are too. How about coming back with me for a drink? Believe it or not, I've managed to put my hands on a bottle of scotch, gift from a grateful lady patient. Can I tempt you?"
"To your house?" I said in some surprise.
"Why not? Come on. You'll be doing my liver a favour by taking a glass or two, for otherwise I'll only drink the whole damn bottle myself."
It seemed months, suddenly, since I had done anything as ordinary as sitting down in another man's home with a glass of liquor. So I said I would. We wrapped ourselves up against the cold and headed out to our cars, he in his slightly flamboyant way in a thick brown coat and a pair of fur driving mittens, which made him look like something like a genial bear, I, more modestly, in my overcoat and muffler. I set off first, but he soon overtook me in his Packard, speeding recklessly along the frosty country lanes. When 25 minutes later I drew up at the gate of his house, he was already inside, already setting out the bottle and glasses and making up the fire. His house was a rambling Edwardian place, full of bright, untidy rooms. He had married quite late in life, and he and his young wife Christine had 4 good-looking children. As I let myself in through the unlocked front door, 2 of the children were in the process of chasing each other up and down the staircase. Another was beating a tennis ball against the drawing-room door.
"God damn you blasted kids!"
Seeley bellowed from the doorway of his study. He waved me into the room beyond him, apologizing for the chaos. But he had an air, too, of being secretly pleased by it, and proud of it, as people often were, I'd noticed, when complaining of their large, noisy families to bachelors like me. That thought put a distance between us. He and I had worked together as amiable rivals for nearly 20 years, but we had never exactly been friends. As he uncorked the bottle, I looked at my watch and said, "You'd better make it a small one. I've a heap of prescriptions to do up tonight." But he let the whiskey flow.
"All the more reason to pour it stiff. Give your patients some surprises. God, this smells good, doesn't it? Here's fun."
We touched glasses and drank. He gestured with his tumbler to a couple of dilapidated armchairs, hooking a foot around one to draw it closer to the fire for me, then doing the same with the other for himself, rucking up the dusty rug in the process and not caring. From out in the hall the thunder of children went on, and in another minute the door was flung open, and one of the good-looking boys put in his head and said, "Father!"
"Get out!" roared Seeley.
"But, sir—"
"Get out, or I'll cut off your ears. Where's your mother?"
"She's out in the kitchen with Rosie."
"Well, go and pester her, you little sub."
The door was closed with a bang. Seeley sipped violently at his whisky, at the same time fishing in his pocket for his case of players. For once I beat him to it, with my own case and lighter, and he sat back with the cigarette gripped between his lips.
"Scenes from domestic life," he said, with a show of weariness. "Do you envy me, Faraday? You shouldn't. A family man never makes a good family doctor. He has too many worries of his own. There ought to be a law making physicians single men like Catholic priests. They'd be the better for it."
"You don't believe that for a moment," I said, after drawing on my own cigarette. "Besides, if it were true, I'd be the proof of it."
"Well, and so you are. You're a finer doctor than I am. You had a harder journey to get there, too."
I raised a shoulder. I wasn't much of a shining example tonight.
"Oh, routine work. You bring out the goods when the goods are needed. You said yourself you've things on your mind." "Want to talk about that? I'm not trying to pry, by the way. I know it helps. Sometimes, that's all, to chew over difficult cases with another medical man."
He spoke lightly but sincerely, and the slight resistance I'd been feeling, a resistance to the charm of his manner, his untidy house, his handsome family, began to ebb. Perhaps it was simply the whisky doing its work, or the warmth of the fire. The room was such a contrast to my dreary bachelor home, a contrast, too, I realized suddenly, to Hundreds Hall. I had a vision of Caroline and her mother, as they probably were at this time of night, hunched and chill and fretful at the heart of that dark, unhappy house. I turned the glass of whisky in my hand. "Perhaps you can guess my trouble, Seeley," I said. "Or part of it." I didn't look up, but saw him lift his own glass. He took a sip and said quietly,
"Caroline Ayres, you mean? I thought it must be something along those lines. You took my advice, did you, after that dance?"
I moved uncomfortably, and before I could answer, he went on,
"I know, I know. I was filthy drunk that night and bloody impertinent. But I meant what I said. What's gone wrong? Don't tell me the girl's turned you down. Too much on her mind, I suppose. Come on, you can trust me. I'm not drunk now. Besides—"
Now I did look up. "What?"
"Well, one can't help but hear rumours."
"About Caroline?"
"About the whole family."
He spoke more gravely.
"A Birmingham friend of mine does some part-time consulting for John Warren. He told me what a shocking state Roderick's in. A nasty business, isn't it? I'm not surprised if it's begun to get Caroline down. Now there's been some other sort of incident, I gather, out at the hall."
"There has," I said, after a moment of silence.
"And I don't mind telling you, Seeley, the case is such a bloody queer one, I hardly know what to make of it."
And I told him pretty much the whole story, beginning with Rod and his delusions, then describing the fire, the scribbles on the walls, the phantom rings on the call bells, and boldly recounting Mrs. Ayres's horrible experience up in the nurseries. He listened in silence, occasionally nodding, occasionally letting out a bark of grim laughter. But his laughter faded as the tale went on, and when I had finished he sat still for a moment, then leaned forward to flick ash from his cigarette. And what he said as he sat back was,
"Poor Mrs. Ayres. A pretty elaborate way of cutting one's wrists, wouldn't you say?"
I looked at him. "That's how you see the case, then?"
"My dear fellow, what else? Unless the wretched woman was simply the victim of someone's idea of a nasty joke. I suppose you've ruled that out."
"I have," I said. "Of course."
"Well, then, the footsteps in the passage, the heavy breathing in the tube. It seems a pretty plain case of psychoneurosis to me. She feels guilty about the loss of her children, Roderick as well as the little girl. She started punishing herself. It was up in the nursery, as you say, that the incident took place. Could she have chosen a more significant setting for the whole affair?"
I had to confess that the same idea had struck me. Just as 3 months before, I'd been impressed by the fact of the Hundreds fire having broken out in what was effectively the estate office, among the estate papers, as if it were a concentration of all Roderick's frustration and dismay.